Good afternoon. Welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to KFM. It's Thursday, the 2nd of February. It's Caoimhe Hearney with you here until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Colin Connolly from Annalee Counselling and Psychotherapy in Selbridge and Naas. He'll be having a general chat with us about mental health because a new survey from last July says that as many as 1 in 3 people here say they have sought help on a therapist's couch. Then we'll be speaking to Dermot O'Leary, General Secretary of the INBRU. Irish Rail received 440 antisocial behaviour complaints last year, a 60% increase on the 277 it received in 2021. Is it time for a dedicated transport police? Then we'll be speaking to Krisha Lynch. She's a maternity care expert. Doctors say women should be given a course on how to improve their pelvic floor health throughout their lives. And then lastly, we'll be speaking to Martina Kenny, co-founder of My Lovely Horse Rescue Charity. She says it's overwhelmed with pigs and can't take any more in. If you want to get in touch with the show, it's 045 898 999. You can email us studio at kfmradio.com or you can text us.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hearney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, according to a study that was carried out last July, as many as 1 in 3 people here say they have sought help on a therapist's couch, with the majority reporting feelings of stress and anxiety. And I'm joined on the line now by Colin Connolly of Annalee Counselling and Psychotherapy in Selbridge and Naas. Good afternoon, Colin.
Hi, Caoimhe. How are you? Lovely to speak to you and to your listeners as well.
Great to have you on, Colin. Listen, Colin, I suppose when you think about therapy and counselling, sometimes I know definitely for me, when I used to think of therapy, I would associate it with an American movie because it wasn't something that was largely spoken around Irish waters, you know?
Yeah, very much so. And I think the kind of, if we wonder where the stigma comes from, you know, associated with people attending therapy, there is that visualization of the therapist on the couch and, you know, somebody with lots of problems. And I think it's something we probably have to really address. And I think even the platform today for yourself to discuss this helps. It helps people to remove that stigma. And I suppose in advance of speaking today, I spoke to two partners, Jennifer Foran and Evelyn Burke, in our practice. And we were just briefly discussing what brings people to therapy. So we work with people from the very young right up to the very old. But on a very basic level, people seek very different things in therapy. And sometimes it really comes back down to some degree of problem solving. Yes, there is therapy for addiction and various support services, but very often it can be just routine, mundane matters of life that people want to talk about and get support with.
Yeah, of course. And for every person, that could be different. I think sometimes, Colin, people are reluctant to go forward because they think, well, I'm not as bad as my neighbour, or, you know, I've had a great childhood, or I've had a great life. I shouldn't feel this way. But you don't have to have an array of problems necessarily to seek therapy, do you?
Not at all. And I think that's probably, for me, if there was a message in today in speaking to you, it would be to encourage people, young and old. And genuinely, if somebody's listening in today and they have a family member, be it a young child or an old parent or a grandparent, to just kind of encourage them to talk. And having a space, and people are sometimes curious about, so what does a therapy room look like, or what does the space look like? And very much for me, our therapy room at Annalee, and I'm sure at any therapist, it's a confidential space, and it allows you to explore whatever it is you need to explore. And I always encourage people, you know, from the first time somebody will sit with me or with one of our therapists, what do I need to do for this person at this time? Because very often the presenting issue, and the presenting issue is usually what a person comes to a therapist with it. First of all, sometimes, so people might wonder how you come to therapy. Your GP might, most people, we get a lot of referrals through GP practices and through schools. So a GP might, you know, observe in an individual that they might need an extra space that is outside of medication or that is outside of the current supports. So when they get that opportunity to come and speak, it can be life-changing for people, genuinely life-changing.
Yeah, and I suppose historically in Ireland, we probably wouldn't have the greatest track record in terms of speaking about things or being open. A friend of mine who was American once said to me, Irish people talk to everyone about the other person, but they never address the problem head on. And when she said that to me, I was like, God, that's actually so true. And it's sometimes we tend to sweep things under the carpet and hope that they go away, Colin, don't we?
Yeah, very much so. And I think that's always been attributed to, I suppose, to male mental health in this country and men's health, very much not talking. And if we think of the generations in Ireland, you know, what we've gone through, we've been impacted generation after generation by major events. And, you know, again, if we look back, you know, we have to really look at the moment, and collectively, we're still coming to terms with what has been a very difficult few years across the world. So this has had an impact on people. A lot of people are still coming to terms with this, you know, regardless of your age. And to some degree, this is lingering on. So when we talk about things like COVID and the restrictions and cocooning, isolation, it's still lingering with a lot of stuff going on in the world. So in the therapy room now at the moment, what does that look like? It looks like people coming in, you know, of all ages, really trying to process what is going on for them. We're looking at financial stress. We're looking at, you know, when we talk about lighting and heating bills, that comes into people's day-to-day life. When I look then as well at some of the older people that I work with, and when I say older, I'm talking about parents and grandparents. So we have grandparents who are now providing childcare, the family constellations, how people live, the homes they live in. There's a lot of processing going on for people. And very often the safest place to get that is with a professional and qualified counsellor or psychotherapist, where you can have a secure, safe space, which is, you know, which is held in a professional manner.
Yeah, sometimes when people think about counselling, I think they think that they can only go when something major happens. So like a major, you know, a change in life, or, you know, a death, or maybe a marriage breakdown. But even if you, let's say, are, you know, 85 and your husband has passed away and nothing major happened, like, and people might say, oh, well, he lived a good life, and he, you know, didn't he have a great life, and he was such and such an age, but it doesn't make it any better. And it might be helpful for even someone like that to go to counselling, Colin.
Yeah, very, very much. So totally in agreement. And even as I discussed this with Jennifer and Evelyn as well, one of the points that came back was people moving through illness and life transitions, just general day-to-day life. And, you know, we hear of people who are emigrating now, people missing their family. That has always happened. But every family and every individual needs a place where they can actually, I suppose, sit and come to terms with what's going on in their life. Because, again, that piece of, yes, there are people who come to therapy who are, you know, will be depressed and will have low mood and will need a certain type of support. But equally, there are people who will engage in therapy. And me as a therapist myself, I will engage in therapy because it's my gym. It's my mental health gym, as I always like to refer to it. That's the place I go for me to spend a bit of time to process what's going on in my life. So I think it's a really healthy habit to get into as well.
According to this survey that was carried out last year, Colin, those most likely to be struggling to cope with levels of stress are female, aged 24 to 49, and are either single or the mothers of young children. Is that something that you would see cross over into your practice?
Yes, again, like when we listen, say, to our team and our feedback. So Anna Lee, we're based in Naas and Selbridge. So we cover North Kildare, South Kildare, and we stretch into the surrounding counties. But yes, very much that is our clientele. That's our client base that comes. And if you think of you know, I always think of young mothers, young parents. We do a lot of parental support work. And some of that is about helping people, you know, maybe returning to work after a pregnancy, all that's involved in that for young mothers and dads as well. And the opposite side of that, we deal with issues like fertility for that age group. When you then stretch it on a little bit, we're touching into menopause and perimenopause. And we have, you know, it's expert support and, you know, kindness really that's needed in that space, where a person can discuss or explore what's going on in their life. So these are very normal events in people's lives. And I think having therapy, having a place to go to is essential, really. And I think we've moved away from the medical model of that a prescription and you're fine. I think we need a little bit more to back that up nowadays. And our work is very much complementary of the GP practices that we work with as well. It really helps.
Yeah. When we think about men then, and Irish men, I suppose, in particular, if we're thinking about Kildare, sometimes men might feel, you know, to be masculine or to be manly, they have to be strong and silent. And especially within the family, it might be seen that they're the ones that have to carry the load. And therefore, you know, they can't be talking about their problems. But they can fall under quite a heavy burden, Colin, can't they?
Yes, and again, we have that classic view of the male-female divide, which we really need to move away from. And, you know, it's a disservice to everybody to kind of stay rigid in those roles. We need to accept that both men and women have, you know, equal demands on them. Like the world we live in now compared to the world that people existed in years ago just has different pressures associated with it. And, you know, traditionally men are not very good at speaking. Very often that can end up in very poor coping strategies, which can be alcohol or drugs or substance. But when you can get in early, and I mean that for people listening in this morning in men's groups or women's groups or just even any group, early intervention is very important. You know, if you're an employer, encouraging your staff to talk to somebody, if you're a club or a team, encouraging that team to get in and, you know, talk to each other before it becomes a problem, I think it's massively important. When we look at men's mental health, you know, we look at diagnosis, again, illness and certain diagnoses that relate to men. You know, it's another space where they need to be able to come in and talk about challenges to their identity and what's happening in life. So, again, encouraging men, I'm an advocate for encouraging everybody to speak. You know, I think it's really important.
I actually have a text in, Colin, and I want to read it out. I'm not going to say the name, but I will say it's from a man. And I'm sure this is something that you probably see all the time. It is an older man. He says, "I've never heard such muck spoken. Get your head out of the phone and apps and look up and around and chat to your family and close friends and you save yourself the pocket money full. Your pocket full of money." That's probably an undertone of things we see on a wider society basis, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, and I totally understand that, and I would have heard that from lots of people. And it is a viewpoint. Yes. Let's be honest. Today, a lot of us do have our heads stuck in the phones and the iPads and working, but they're, you know. I'm just thinking in terms of the cost of therapy as well. And it can be a barrier to some people, but I always say therapy is you try and get it to be accessible for people. But in my experience and in the experience of working, that it's not just that simple. Sometimes it's like saying to a person who's struggling with depression or mental health to give yourself a shake and get on with it. Sometimes it's just not that straightforward. There's a bit more involved in it.
Yeah, or even saying to someone who's, you know, crazily or vastly overweight to stop eating. Like it's not that simple, Colin, is it?
Yeah, not at all. I think it's very much when we look at a person, you have to take the wider approach to people. And it's not for everybody in terms. Some people have a certain way about themselves in terms of that's not for me. But in my experience, if, you know, I've sat with men and women who might have reflected back on and said, okay, I wasn't sure what this was going to be, but at the end of it, they've got something for themselves, or it's become maybe a catalyst for something else happening in their life.
Yeah. What would you say to people listening out there who have similar views to my last texter there or would be reluctant to therapy, Colin?
I think you'll always get people who are reluctant for therapy, and sometimes it can be from a place of fear, as in, what do I expect? And genuinely, I fully appreciate as well for people that, you know, financial pressure and stress on people nowadays is difficult. So trying to put therapy into your life can be prohibitive for some people. But I find there are so many services offering affordable counselling and psychotherapy that I think it's worth taking the effort. It's worth making the effort. And we talk a lot now in the world about people putting themselves first and trying to, you know, genuinely sometimes just be that little bit selfish to mind themselves, mind their health. Because, and I think if we reflect on what we've come through, you know, we've had a real challenge to mortality in the world, and there's a big shift in everybody's way of thinking. So allowing yourself to put yourself in a space where you can put yourself first, have some compassion maybe, some kindness shown to you, I don't think there's too much that is wrong with that. I think it actually could be a healthy place to be.
Okay, well, that is Colin Connolly there and of Annaly Counselling and Psychotherapy in Selbridge and Naas, just giving us a general chat on mental health and what's involved. So thank you very much, Colin, for your time.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, many of you may have heard that Irish Rail has received 444 antisocial behaviour complaints last year, a 60% increase compared to the year previous. And I'm joined now on the line by Dermot O'Leary, General Secretary of the NBRU. And Dermot, it's not good news, really, is it?
I spoke to KFM before on this subject, and unfortunately, it's something that's occurring, and it's 444 reported. There's a lot of incidents now at this stage. Behaviours become somewhat normalised. There's a lot more stuff going on our trains and indeed our buses than that report would indicate. So yes, look, it's on the rise, unfortunately, and our members are experiencing on a daily basis, commuters on trains as well. So it's a problem we've been highlighting for quite a while. And look, one of the suggestions we've made, people will know that one solving on its own, but certainly a dedicated Garda public transport unit, we believe, will go a long way towards reducing a significant amount of that type of behaviour.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that the staff are more affected by the abuse, Dermot?
I spoke to staff myself directly. I have been on a regular basis, and look, some of them might know quite well, going back over many years, and they would be working in the job in long service, and they would be saying to me they'd never in their lives imagine that they go to work and fear in some cases, because they know themselves where the incidents happen. In some cases, they know the perpetrators quite well. In other cases, they know, what stations people are going to get on and off. So, depending on their roster, and that's just a fact of life for a lot of staff these days, they know facing into whatever week they're on, whatever roster they're on, they know that there's a potential to face up to either physical abuse, verbal abuse, certainly threats of sexual assault on some of our female members and the likes, and a lot of it is to do with drugs and drink, obviously, So it is a daily occurrence, unfortunately.
Would there be much drinking on the Irish Rail lines, Dermot?
Well, Irish Rail have moved recent times to ban drinking on trains, and that's difficult in itself to police. And one of the problems we have, I suppose, for our members, in a lot of cases, are their customer service officers, what they are, our train hosts on the Cork Dublin line, for example, and they're there to help and make the journey a pleasurable experience. So they're not necessarily police, or they're not Gary, certainly, and they're not security. So there's a difficulty in trying to police people that bring alcohol or manage to get alcohol onto trains. But look, people get on trains, after having consumed drink. Drugs is a different matter altogether. And look, it's well known, I suppose, that a lot of drugs have been ferried up and down Cork Dublin train, for example. And the guards, in fairness to them, in relation to that element, obviously that's a very undercover operation that they performed there, and they've had some successes. But look, again, our members would tell us quite clearly there's open drug taking going on there. They find syringes in toilets and stuff like that as well. And look, there's been a couple of videos on social media over recent years where people were doing lines of coke off a table on a train. So look, again, it's a day in the life, really, of a transport worker these days, unfortunately.
So if a Irish Rail worker comes across a group of people taking cocaine, say, for example, like, do they go over and say, look, you can't do that here? Or is it too dangerous for them?
It's too difficult. And I mean, the advice we would give to our people is not to get involved in that type of scenario. I mean you can't really. Look, we all know there was a time you can intervene in any type of disturbance, and you might get a verbal riposte, but now there can be, it goes extremes. And I've been saying to politicians who've been very supportive of our call for a dedicated Garda public transport unit, I've been saying to those politicians, stop giving me words of support, go away and legislate to make this force happen. There is a problem in the guards. We all know there is, in relation to resources. And If government came to us and said, look, we're going to legislate for the establishment of a dedicated Garda public transport unit, but we don't have the resources for it to be active just yet, then at least people could see some benefit coming from that. Because at the moment, there is no sanction. Irish Rail, to be fair to them, has spent an awful lot of money on security, but those people that are involved in security don't have the powers of detention and arrest. And there is no sanction for these people at the end of their behaviour.
Yeah, and I remember myself, I lived out in New York for a while, and when I used to get the subway, let's say it was the 33rd stop, by the time I got to my stop on the 40th, if something had happened on 33rd Street, literally the cops would be there on the 40th stop, and it would be there. You know, there just was no messing, Dermot, because there couldn't be, you know?
No, they couldn't be. And New York has a transit police, which is part of their police force in New York significantly. So that's one that would be a good model, albeit on a bigger scale over there. But again, look, no one expects the guard to be on every train, but the fact that the guard of force that would exist would reduce, we believe, a lot of the behaviour that's happening out there. Now, some of the more serious stuff around, you know, the drugs and all that, you know, that's a societal issue. We all know antisocial behaviour itself is a societal issue, and it is difficult. But again, as I said, both our staff and members of the public are facing it. And the other thing, of course, to consider is that lots of money, hundreds of millions, in fact, quite rightly, be ploughed into public transport now. And we're trying to encourage new people, new commuters to get on buses and trains. So, listening to the likes of me and reading articles about antisocial behaviour, that wouldn't encourage people to take a bus or a train.
No.
That's another problem we have.
Yeah, we've heard here anecdotally about passengers booking seats in advance, Dermot, only to get on the train and find other people sitting in their reserved seat. And, you know, people on the person on the train or working for Irish Rail saying, look, there's nothing I can do. And this is what we hear a lot. So it's not really going to change until there is a dedicated transport police.
It would appear to be the case. And I mean, in fairness to people that work on Irish Rail, they do go to people tend to, you know, to move from the seat. If it's not their seat, there's a dead seat. And surely that's the case. It's like the abuse they get, you know, it's just, you know, it's phenomenal what's happening out there, to be honest with you. And again, look, I look at it with pleasure having these conversations. I'd rather, you know, be talking about the good experience you have, and people should be travelling more and more on public transport, and we'd always like that. We'd all like to see that, but unfortunately these incidents are happening, and it's not going to go away anytime soon, unfortunately.
What do you think in the short term can be done, Dermot?
Well, again, look, it's difficult. I mean, Irish Rail has spent a lot of money in security, and I know that the security company involved itself, the subcontract out, or subcontractors, I should say, they're finding it difficult themselves to recruit security staff. So there is a major issue. I'm stopping short of establishing that dedicated Garda Public Transport Division. And again, we've also been calling for mandatory sentences for assaults on frontline staff, the guards themselves, ambulance workers, fire brigades, and indeed transport staff. There should be mandatory sentences for people that assault frontline services personnel. That's another issue we've been calling for. So, at such time as people see sanctions coming their way and visibly see people are being punished for this type of behaviour, it's not going to reduce. In actual fact, it probably will increase.
Okay, well, that is Dermot O'Leary there, General Secretary of the NBRU, with that news that Irish Rail received 444 antisocial behaviour complaints last year, a 60% increase on the amount that they received in 2021. So thanks very much to Dermot O'Leary. Now, changing tack a small bit, and listen up if you are a woman, because I'm joined on the line by Krisha Lynch. She's a maternity care expert, and there was a new survey carried out over in the UK, and it said that doctors say that women should be given a course on how to improve their pelvic floor health throughout their lives, because just one in five women across the UK, or 22%, perform these exercises regularly. That's according to this new poll. And I'm joined now by Krisha. Good afternoon, Krisha.
Hi, Caoimhe.
Krisha, this probably doesn't come as a shock to you, does it?
No, not at all, because that study, of course, was carried out in the UK and reported in the Belfast Telegraph. So it's not really talking about people here in Ireland, but we know that there are very similar situations here in Ireland, and perhaps a little bit worse. There's a great website that your listeners can go on if they want to find out more about that, and it's called MAMMI, M-A-M-M-I, and it was a study carried out in Trinity, and it actually has a little course about you know, how to deal with your pelvic floor and how to strengthen it after you've had a baby, which isn't the only time, of course, that our pelvic floors become weaker. But their study noted quite categorically that very, very few people are given any support or any information, or would actually think that some things which are really not normal would think that they're normal. So let's just say it out loud that if you're having urinary incontinence, or if you feel that you're peeing when you're coughing, or if you feel that you have to pee very frequently, that isn't normal. And that would indicate that there might be something amiss with your pelvic floor. It may be too tight, or it may be too slack. And in fact, that's one of the other issues that we come across a lot, is that there's a lot of emphasis when it is placed, is placed on everybody doing all this like clenching and squeezing. And that's only half the issue. The other half of the issue is that we need to be able to relax the pelvic floor. And in relaxing the pelvic floor and strengthening it, we get a balanced pelvic floor, because you'd be surprised at how many people have issues because their pelvic floor is too tight.
Okay, so yeah, like it is something that I, even as a woman, would associate with women maybe who are older or have had a couple of children. But you're saying that's not the case, Krisha?
No, not necessarily. There's lots of things that can affect your pelvic floor. Your pelvic floor is related to your core. So if people are bearing too much weight, so for example, if people are overweight, have a high BMI, for example, or if people are doing a lot of weight-bearing exercise and they're actually doing a little bit too much, that can have an impact on their pelvic floor. As women go through hormonal changes, so people in the perimenopause, you know, before the menopause comes, that sort of time, maybe from late 30s on to late 40s, early 50s, that time will people have hormonal changes. And usually what happens is people's estrogen levels falls a little bit, and that's going to make musculature a little weaker. So it's a hormonal thing. And then during menopause, there's more weakness that might come in. So it's not just childbirth, but childbirth, I guess, is one of the big things. And, you know, what we find after birth in Ireland is that there's a very, very limited discussion about pelvic floor. You know, there might be discussion about if you've had any tears or you had any stitches after birth, or maybe you had a complicated delivery. There might be some discussion about your perineum, which is a completely different part of your anatomy, but very little about the pelvic floor, which is like, it's like a shopping bag or a hammock that holds all the organs together. So very little. And I remember after I had my first baby, my mom had a visitor from France, and she said to me, are you going to your pelvic floor spa? And I thought, well, what's that? Sounded like something I'd order off the internet. And she said to me, no. You know, where you go to the spa and you see the physiotherapist just for women and, you know, you get your spa treatments. And I thought, this is a thing? And she was like, oh, yeah, it's a really big thing in France. And I thought, wow, I wish I'd had my baby in France, because it certainly isn't a big thing here. And I guess another thing that's worth mentioning, since we're talking about where it can come about, is, you know, people always think that it's only if you have a vaginal birth that you're going to have pelvic floor issues. And it's not. You know, you can have the same kinds of issues 6 or 7 months after a cesarean birth. And that's something certainly I never knew until I looked into it, that people who've had a cesarean birth are equally as susceptible to pelvic floor issues, you know, after about a year. So really what we need is a lot more information. And thanks so much, Quiva, for having me on and for raising it. Because even just talking about it and saying what it is, you know, it's this muscle, it's like a hammock, it's down, it goes from your pubic bone. So if any of your listeners, female ones now, are in a place, like not on the bus, don't do this on the bus, but, you know, if you're at home, you could perhaps put your finger on your pubic bone at the front, because that's where the muscle joins to, and then all the way around the back where your coccyx is, or where if you had a tail it would be, kind of joins there, and then on those two big bones that you sit on, so it kind of forms this diamond shape, and that is that big muscle that is holding the bladder from where you'd wee, it's holding the vagina, and it's holding also the anus from where you'd poo out of. So it's holding all of those things. So you can see that if that were to become a little bit weak, any one of those organs can get slightly misplaced, can come a little bit further down, can move a little bit to one side and place more pressure on one of the other organs. And what women often note is that they have this incontinence of some kind, stress incontinence or frequency, and that is an indication that something might be off with their pelvic floor. So yeah, what can you do? What can you do? That's the next thing, is go to your GP, talk to your GP about it. And I know, for example, in Kildare, there's fabulous yoga studios there that focus on this kind of thing. I think Studio 3 in Naas, that's a great one. And there's a fabulous community midwife called Anya, who also works out of Naas. And you can find support for what you can do, what kind of exercises you can do, and how you can improve your health and not have the discomfort of having to go to your supermarket and buy incontinence pads, potentially for the rest of your life, unless you sort it out.
Okay, so basically what you're saying is if women are listening in and they do have this problem, it can be fixed. You can fix it.
Oh, absolutely, you can fix it. And sometimes it's a lot easier to fix than people realise. So there are physiotherapists who specialise when the problem is significant. And I know that one of my colleagues went to somebody in Dublin and she said, oh, it was great. She had this orgasmatron machine. And I was like, wow, what's that? And she said, oh, you know, it sort of measured how tightly I could use and squeeze within parts of my pelvic floor. So I'm not guaranteeing that everybody that will go will get an orgasmatron machine. But there are all sorts of exercises that can be done. There is surgery, of course, but that's what everybody's trying to avoid. Daily exercises in relaxing and releasing the pelvic floor, as well as strengthening it, can probably help the majority of people. And the best way to find out about those is through something like yoga or Pilates. And often, for people who've just had a baby, you can do postnatal yoga or you can do postnatal Pilates, and you can get that, strength and that balance back. If it's been years, then probably you need to go and see a physiotherapist, and they'll give you exercises that you can do at home to give you the strength and the balance. And if it's gone really far, then you potentially are talking about surgery, but that would be less than 1% of cases. That's very, very small.
Okay, well, listen, Krisha, just before I let you go, like, how does it feel if someone's at home now and they want to try and, like, do pelvic floor exercise? How do they do it?
Okay, so the best way of doing pelvic floor support work is to do it with your breathing. So what I'd suggest is, again, if you're at home, don't do it on the bus. But although once you know what to do, you probably should do it on the bus, or you should do it when you wait in queues. I always think, well, waiting in queues is a wonderful benefit for my pelvic floor, because whenever I'm waiting in a queue, I do my pelvic floor exercises. So basically, the first starting point I would always say to people is, you know, maybe sit on your hand so you have a feeling of the area that you're trying to support. And then start off by trying to bring your breath down so that you're breathing through your tummy. You're breathing in and your tummy's expanding. What a lot of us do is we breathe in through our chest and our chest expands. So you can put your other hand on your chest and just check it out. And when I breathe in, is it my chest that's rising? No. Okay, that's good. It must be my tummy that's rising. And as you breathe in and your tummy extends outwards, just feel that extension coming downwards and that you're also breathing into the hand you're sitting on. And then when you breathe out, get that feeling. Remember I said it was like a diamond. Mm. You've got that diamond front and back of the pubic bone and the coccyx and then the two sit bones. Think of that diamond and imagine it's like you're pulling that up. So it's like taking a tissue out of a box, that sort of imagery. And as you breathe out, just draw that up. And as you breathe in again, just relax everything and breathe out again. And then as you breathe out, just bring it up. Imagine drawing it up. And that is a great start.
Okay.
If you can do that and focus on that 10 times, twice a day, that'll be a brilliant start.
Okay, well, that is Krisha Lynch, their maternity care expert, with all of those great tips on how to improve your pelvic floor health through your life. So do take Krisha up on all her good tips. Thanks very much, Krisha. Now, an animal rescue shelter has said it is overwhelmed with pigs and they can't take any more in. And I'm joined now on the line by Martina Kenny. She's co-founder of My Lovely Horse Rescue Charity. Good afternoon, Martina.
Afternoon.
Martina, why pigs, and has it become a little bit of a phenomenon?
I think it always was. I think just because there was no actual pig rescue, proper pig rescue, I don't really know what happened to the poor things really at one point. But I suppose years ago when Babe came out, everybody wanted a pig. And then you see these, you know, Instagram and TikTok all about these little micro pigs. So people buy a micro pig for, a guy buys them for his girlfriend. And then it turns out to be a huge pig. Only the other day we had a message in, a man bought his child a pig for Christmas and already they don't want it. So it is a bit crazy and there is no such thing as a micro pig. And because people know we rescue them, now we're just overwhelmed with God loves them poor pigs, you know.
So, Martina, you're saying that there is no such thing as a micro pig in Ireland, is it?
There's no such thing as a micro pig anywhere. There is no tiny little pigs. Like, they all grow up. There's different sizes, different types, but there certainly is not a little micro pig. It was, you know, it's just, it's just that thing where it looks like they are, when born, they do kind of, you know, unlike a puppy or a little kitten or even a foal or whatever, they're not so floppy. And, you know, when a pig is born, it's literally born, you know, okay, I'm here, and little teeth and fighting, sitting, running around. So it does look like it's a bit older, but it's certainly not, and it's going to grow. And sometimes they can grow up to, like, you know, some of ours are about 45, 50 stone.
Okay, so you see some celebrities and they have these pigs and they stay small for a long time. Is there any reason for that then? Like, are they giving them...
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not going to grow. Like, some of them would, you know, some of our pigs are pot-belly pigs, wouldn't be huge.
Okay.
But, you know, they would be small for quite a while, and then by the time they're about 2 to 3, they do start to grow a bit more then.
Okay.
But, yeah.
So what do you do with all these pigs now that you have? How many do you have, Martina?
Well, on my lovely pig rescue part, we have 160. And on the main, my lovely horse rescue farm in Kildare, we have 16. And they're the pigs that will always kind of be there. They meet the public, whatever. And then the ones that, like, we just recently had a load born. We took four pregnant mothers in, and some of them were old. So some of the pigs, the piglets didn't survive the birth. We've had a horrible, actually, 2 weeks of just horrible, poor pigs in labour, and two had to get into UCD for cesarean sections because, you know, people don't do this. They don't neuter the pigs either. You know, like, a girl pig can be neutered and should be, and the boy for definite should be, you know, neutered. But that's another thing they don't do. So, and a pig has, you know, could have 14, 15 piglets.
Okay, but surely if you had a female pig at home, like, how many pigs is it going to come in contact with, Martina? Would it really need to be neutered?
Yeah. Well, no, not if that's the case. Although we've neutered some of them because they would basically get a monthly whatever, same as any woman kind of thing, and they would be very narky and, you know, kind of not vicious, but get annoyed about life.
Okay.
We've literally said that poor pig needs a bar of chocolates and a rom-com type of thing. So it's mad, you know, it's mad how humanized they are too, and how amazing they are. But if somebody just has one pig anyway, it's not good. You should have two. They really do love the company of their own type as well. And they do need a lot of space. Like, it's not just something to just have, you know.
Okay, so just to be clear, because I think this will be taking a lot of people by surprise, there is no such thing as a micro pig. Every pig gets bigger. I think we've lost Martina there. So we've seen the end of it there. But I think what Martina was saying was that there is actually no such thing as a micro pig, which I'm shocked at because I thought that there was. And she's saying that some of the pigs will stay small for a while, but then, you know, maybe it's something got to do with, like, around the time of puberty or something, they hit a stage where they will just gain a huge amount of weight. And like she said there, she had a man in Finglas who bought a pig for his girlfriend as a surprise. The pig went up to 45 stone. So, you know, like, obviously, especially if you're living in a housing estate, or if you have a small garden, or even if you're living in an apartment, like, that would just be nightmare stuff to have a 45 stone pig running around the house, especially with all of your different nice furniture, I assume. The advice there, I suppose, from my lovely horse rescue farm is not to be buying pigs because they will all grow up in the end. So you won't be able to do much with them when that happens. And they have 120 pigs there that they are trying to care for, I suppose, and get them minded. So I'm not sure what they do. We didn't get to ask Martina there in the end what was going to happen with those pigs, but it's interesting to know that there's no such thing as a micro pig. Now, I have had a few messages in here. Unfortunately, someone has sent in a voice note that I actually can't listen to until I'm off air, so I apologise for that. I do have a message in here. Hi, I heard your chat with Akrisha on pelvic floor problems. I work with pregnant ladies too, during pregnancy, before birth and after. I would just add to Krisha's comment and mention that energy makes every organ function well. I practice classical acupuncture in Dublin. So I suppose that the advice there is energy, good energy makes everything go good. And then there's another message in here. Martina is correct. There is no such thing as a micro pig. They grow very big. Some pigs can grow to 45 stone. Check out the My Lovely Pig Rescue Facebook page. And that is where Martina was coming from. She is from My Lovely Horse Rescue. So if you do want to go onto their website, you'll be able to see all the pigs that they have there. That's all I have time for today. I'll be back again at the same time tomorrow between 2 and 3. Owen Beattie is up next with your headlines. Actually, sorry, I won't be back tomorrow. I'll be in Lisbon, but I'll be back on Wednesday because I'm going away for my birthday. But Owen Beattie will be with you tomorrow, and I'll be back next Wednesday. Have a lovely weekend, and I will talk to you next week.